The kingdoms of this world lie in his hands. See how they rise or fall at his command. Through sorrow and distress, tempestuous storms that rage, God's kingdom yet endures from age to age.
This is Mission 66, brought to you by TWR and the Bible Teaching Ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we're stepping into 2 Samuel, offering timeless lessons of repentance, justice, mercy, and relying on God's guidance. You can follow along with your downloadable study guide at mission66.org. Here's John Matthews with Esther Sisulu to guide our study.
Our journey through the life-giving Word of God, the Bible, continues right here on Mission 66. 1 Samuel told us about the rise of the prophet Samuel and the reign of King Saul, from his anointing to his tragic death 40 years later. But we were also introduced to David, the giant killer, and his rise to the kingdom, which is now chronicled in 2 Samuel. Here's our teacher, John Matthews, who will present to us the first chapter with the theme, Appropriate Mourning.
Esther, thank you so much, and a very warm welcome to Mission 66. Wherever you join us from today, it is good to be with you. And you know, in recent episodes, we've been in the first book of Samuel, which explains this transition from the period of the judges to the monarchy in Israel. Now, the ancient Hebrew monarchy began then in the 11th century BC before Christ with Saul, a king who ultimately was rejected by God because he followed his own way rather than God's. Now, as we begin the second book of Samuel, it is important to note that the Jewish tradition considers both of these books actually as one unified work. So whilst the second book of Samuel begins as if it were a separate book, it's actually a continuation of the first. And in this second book, the focus now shifts to David, probably the greatest king of Israel. And chapter one here introduces us to his character. We already know that Saul had died by his own hand after he was wounded during a battle with the Philistines. And now with the throne temporarily vacant, we witness a transition as the kingdom is finally delivered into David's hands and in fulfillment as well of God's promise. But we see as we look at David, we see no impatience on his part to actually grab and take hold of the throne. And it begins here in chapter one as he's informed about the death of Saul. So let's observe David now and see how he responds and what he says. Verse one. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and he paid homage. And David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he replied, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "Well, by chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind me, he saw me and he called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I said to him, I answered, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I've brought them here to my Lord. Now, there was told a lie. I'm sure as you were listening, you're thinking, hang on, that's not what we read before, because we know that Saul's death was by his own hand, not by the hand of this Amalekite. But notice the situation that David is now facing. Saul, who'd been pursuing David, is now dead. And then David receives this news from a foreigner, an Amalekite, who fabricates his story, seeking to win David's favour by claiming to have killed Saul, David's greatest enemy. His intention is clear. He wants to gain advantage, a political advantage maybe, and secure a reward or position in David's future reign. And he certainly didn't expect the reaction that David gave to this bad news. Verse 11. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." And David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go, execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Now remember the story. David himself had several opportunities to kill Saul, and almost it seemed from David's advisors, you remember what they said to him, "David, God has given Saul into your hands," but David refrains because he considers Saul to have been the Lord's anointed and would not take vengeance against him. Instead, he committed the preservation of his life into God's hands. That's David's own life, and is willing to wait on God's timing for his rise to the throne and for God's way to unfold. So he certainly wasn't going to let this offence by an Amalekite go unpunished, remembering also that the Amalekites were historic enemies of Israel. And in verse 17, it says David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, his son. Now, because David and Jonathan were really good friends, even though Jonathan's father was Saul, when David learned of the deaths, though, of both Saul and his friend Jonathan, we see that it struck him at his very heart, and he cried for Jonathan. And being a musician skilled on the harp, he composes this lament, a lyric poem, if you like, to be sung to music, lamenting the deaths of both Saul and Jonathan. And verse 18 says, "And he said, 'It should be taught to the people of Judah, this lament. Behold, it is written, this lament, in the book of Jashar.'" Now, the book is no longer to be found, but David's lamentation is recorded here from verse 19 in 2 Samuel. And this is how it reads. "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult." David concerned there that Israel's enemies may celebrate the tragedy. The lament goes on. "You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, In life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. And so David doesn't seize this opportunity to advance his own leadership. Instead, he mourns appropriately for Saul, for Jonathan, the Lord's army, and indeed the people of Israel. What stands out here is that David doesn't rejoice in Saul's death or rush to claim the throne. He understands that the kingdom is not his, it's God's to give. And he trusts completely and implicitly in God's timing. And so David grieves for Saul and for Jonathan, and in doing so he shows this remarkable character that has been moulded by God through the trials and the tribulations that he'd suffered.
You're listening to Mission 66, and we are exploring the first chapter of 2 Samuel. Now, of course, we are looking through David's lamentation, and I think John and I kind of have a discussion about this because there's some interesting bits here, John. But I first want to ask you whether David realized that the Amalekite was lying to him.
I think the answer to that must have been no, Esther, because this was the first time that David had heard about this, and he wouldn't have known the actual truth until later on. So, you know, David doesn't explicitly believe or disbelieve the man based on what we can read in this account in the Bible. I believe what happened here was the Amalekite probably came across Saul's body, and he's an opportunist. He grabs certain items that David recognizes clearly belonging to Saul. And the Amalekite, I think, sees this opportunity to ingratiate himself with David, and he hopes to get some kind of reward or promotion or be looked favorably upon when David becomes king. But what David actually does is he administers punishment to the man because he's confessed to committing a murder, even though he didn't do it.
I bet he might have regretted having confessed to that, knowing what his outcome would have been. All right, well, let's go back to the lamentation that David wrote in verse 21. It says here, "You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, no fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil." What does that mean?
Well, these mountains of Gilboa, first of all, they were in northern Israel and a significant part as well in the life of King Saul and his sons. You know, that mountain range was also strategically important because it was the high ground. And it was also noted for its variety of plants and pretty flowers that would grow there, which is interesting, isn't it, in the light of David's word saying, "Let there be no dew now, or rain upon you," know, calling down that, well, I guess that kind of curse upon the land, that part of the mountain.
Yeah. And what about the shields not being anointed with oil?
Yeah, good question. This interesting one, because oiling the shields was something that was done when an army was getting ready for battle. And the thinking was the oil would make the shield slippery, so it would then deflect enemy swords and arrows. Now, look, this is my own opinion about it, but to say that the shields were not oiled speaks to me of Saul not being the aggressor against the Philistines, and that he would have been content to be at peace if possible. So David is suggesting in his lament that this was a battle that really didn't have to be. If the Philistines hadn't attacked, which makes the death of his friend Jonathan even harder to bear.
You know, considering the history between David and Saul, you know, with Saul being David's enemy and persecutor, do you think that David was sincere when he wept for Saul? You know, because I wonder if this poem was actually written with that intention of truly mourning him.
Yeah, I think so. I think he was sincerely sad. You know, he had spent a fair bit of his life, you know, alongside Saul, and there were happier memories early on. And, you know, the verse clearly says there that he mourned appropriately. And Saul was, after all, chosen as the king of Israel. And so David refused to remove him from that position on his own. He said, I'm not going to kill God's anointed. He was going to wait for God to be the one to decide his fate.
I think good on David for making that decision. It's a good lesson for all of us. But let's go ahead and move on to verse 22. Here it says, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back. The sword of Saul returned not empty.
Yeah, and what that means is that Saul and Jonathan weren't cowards. And when it was time to fight, that they fought, and they fought hard, and, you know, they did their best to make the enemy pay for their lives.
You have a great way of dissecting this poetic language, John. Let's go to verse 23. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely. In life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Let's get into that.
Well, again, here David is merely actually giving honor to whom honor is due. And both of them, we can discern from this, were brave and capable warriors. And they weren't divided. That means that Jonathan didn't abandon his father, even in those later years when, you know, his judgment was being called into question, and he was, well, frankly, declining. Jonathan could easily have run off and left his father to his fate, but he didn't. He actually stands by him in the midst of peril. And, you know, let's think about that. Jonathan was David's best friend, and so there must have been an internal tear inside him, and he must have seen David and just witnessed David's grace and his godliness in the way that he dealt with his dad, Saul. But yet he still stands by him right to the last.
And verse 24, you daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet and who put ornaments of gold on your apparel.
Well, that means that the women who may have been tempted to criticize Saul should remember that their country had prospered actually during Saul's reign. And they shouldn't be so quick to criticize the leadership as long as they'd benefited from his rule.
All right, John. Well, now we come to verse 26, and that reads, I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of woman. I think we can really get a sense of just how much David loved Jonathan. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? You know, I've got two brothers myself, and it's sometimes when you have that special bond with somebody, and it doesn't come around that often in life, if at all, sometimes you just don't need to say anything in terms of, you don't need to say any words. There's just almost, you're on a wavelength, and there's a beauty in the relationship, an ease in the relationship, when you just love being with someone, you know, and certainly that is the case, you know, with my brothers. And, you know, David here underlining, oh, well, you used the word brotherhood, or it's a lovely word to use between them, and how special it is to have this friend who in many ways was closer than a brother. And then that reminds me of that lovely verse where it says that Jesus is the friend who sticks closer than any brother ever could. And that is, man, that is a beautiful, lovely thing.
Yeah, that was a beautiful description of their relationship. And I think we all aspire to be in friendships and relationships that are that close. But now let's pay this close attention to the text here, John, because what stands out about David's behavior is this kind of calm demeanor and his attitude towards power. You mentioned that he did not rush to occupy the throne. So he's really laid back about this.
Yeah, he certainly has a perspective, doesn't he? A wise perspective. He's in no hurry to get to the throne. And look, let's put ourselves a little bit in his situation. You know, he's surrounded and will be surrounded by plenty of Saul's relatives, and they're going to hold a grudge against him. They're going to believe that he personally plotted to remove Saul and grab power. So there'll be a lot of misinformation surrounding David. We see it from the perspective of hindsight written in the Bible. We know the beginning of the story from the end. But being in David's position, we might think, oh, God, the way is clear from him now. Just, you know, push on. So, you know, David has people around him who don't have his best interests at heart. But this anger around him was misplaced, because it was God who actually removed Saul and arranged for David to sit on the throne. And actually, human history is one big, long storybook of one king or leader overthrowing or replacing another, the rise and the fall of kingdoms. And we don't always know a person until they get a little bit of power in their hands. And the increase of wealth, of status, of fame often reveals negative sinful traits that may have previously been hidden or covered up. We may look at the news and worry and feel anxious when we see the global uncertainty. But you know, friends, this is nothing new in God's eyes. And he alone will call time on this world. Reminds me of the verse of an old Welsh hymn that goes, "The kingdoms of this world lie in his hands. See how they rise and fall at his command. Through sorrow and distress, tempestuous storms that rage, God's kingdom still endures from age to age."
You know, John, I think we've, for the most part, seen numerous examples of what happens when a young ruler or a young leader isn't properly prepared for the pressures of leadership. And I think in David's case, we've seen how God has really equipped him so that he's able to handle the throne that God would ultimately give him.
Yeah, that's true. And it has happened that a boy becomes king just because he's in the royal line, and he may be ill-prepared for that huge responsibility. We've seen through history as well the opposite happen when a king hangs on, or a leader hangs on too long and passes the point where they're willing or able to listen to good advice. Sometimes we may even think in our own minds, in our own situations with work or whatever it is, why doesn't God put me in charge? I'd fix the problem. But, you know, God knows best, and sometimes he withholds promotion because he knows we're not ready for it yet, even if we think we are.
Amen. God is wise and his timing is perfect. Thanks, John. You know, I really appreciate your insights, and I'd like for us to move into a summary of what we've learned here in the first chapter of 2 Samuel.
Yeah, let's do that. And we observe, don't we, Esther, David's character, really, after learning about the death of Saul, who'd been chasing him all these years and trying to kill him, and in many ways was the inspiration for some of those psalms where he cries out to God for help. This is the same Saul. And yet, how does he respond when this Saul is gone? Well, he mourns for him in an appropriate manner, doesn't gloat over the death of somebody who by now is his mortal enemy. In fact, when the Amalekite comes along with a false report about killing Saul himself, expecting reward, David has him killed. Along with this, we see the death of three of Saul's sons, and that includes Jonathan, who we understand was David's best friend. And there was also the tragedy of a military defeat which threatened the people of Israel going forward. So in this chapter, David composes a lyric poem, probably to be sung to the tune of his harp, and it extols the virtues of Saul and Jonathan, reminding the people not to be too happy about Saul's death, because as he reminded them, they themselves prospered during his reign. You know, those who love God are able to mourn appropriately when tragedy comes. And now here we have David, once a humble shepherd boy tending the sheep in the fields, and now he's set to become King of Israel.
And that's where we leave it for today, dear friends. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Next time, we will take you even further into 2 Samuel as we continue to look at the account of Israel's second king, King David. Now, before we go, I really want to thank you for your prayers and your financial partnership with Mission 66. All of that allows us to reach listeners in multiple languages around the world. Now, if you'd like to make a donation to the ministry, please visit mission66.org. That's mission66.org. Well, until next time, friend, thank you for being here. God bless you.
Let me remind you to head on over to mission66.org to download your study guide. It's free. Dive deeper into the Bible teaching of John Matthews and learn how it all relates to your Christian walk. Tag along with John and Esther on our Bible road trip, episode by episode. Your study guide's waiting for you at mission66.org. That's where you can also post your questions or make a comment, and even help out with a donation to keep Mission 66's heart beating around the world. Hop on over to mission66.org. Mission 66 is a partnership of TWR and the ministry of Dr. Luis Seau.